So sure enough, we went out to Cheyenne in the first part of 1945, and we're out there during the first half of 1945 until May, starting up that plant, and it worked. And but then the war was over, and Mr. Roosevelt passed on, and it was possible then to get released from my defense job. I'd been obviously assigned to that, and that was my job during the war. And so I realized I'd made up my mind early, sometime before, that whenever the time came, I was going to get out of this business of traveling around, because that was no way to raise a family. By that time, we had two boys. One had been born in Chicago, and one had been born in Texas while we were there. And they were beginning to be a family. And I said, this is no way to raise a family, so we're going to go somewhere else. And sure enough, Gulf was desperate, they said, for technical people. And by that time, I felt I perhaps had established myself well enough that I could go to work for Gulf on my own, as opposed to going with the pull of my dad. So I accepted a job at the Port Arthur Refinery as technical specialist in 1945 in May. I went to work there on the 15th of May, I believe it was, 1945.
I have a couple questions about UOP before we move on to golf.
Mm-hmm. Can I, would it mess up your thing if I sit over here for a while?
No. Let me see, though. I might just... one of the things that I was curious about, well, we've talked about the information sharing. Hoodry was, of course, another big factor in catalytic work at that time. And how much interaction did you have with them?
Not much. They were competitors. And the cooperation I mentioned was within the three fraternities. There was the Hoodry fraternity, there was a TCC fraternity, and a Fluid fraternity. And there was not much cooperation between them, because they were highly competitive. Of course, we kept up whatever they put in the literature and made generally available, but as far as direct contact, very little.
Another question was... given the impetus of the war effort and the urgency of accomplishing something, what considerations were there given for environmental aspects?
Very few. That was before the days when environmental aspects were a popular subject. I don't think we were guilty of any gross violations, and of course there was general concern. There was always a concern, but not like today, by any manner of means. And the conservation that was justified was more to save the materials than it was to preserve the environment. And no, I think the industry and all of us share some responsibility for a lack of responsibility back in those days. It's a valid observation that industry was something less than completely responsible in all of its actions. Which, jumping ahead, leads to this, as far as my career is concerned. When I came back to Gulf, well, I'm getting way ahead of the story, but when I was active in API, technical activities, it was primarily in the so-called smoke and fumes area that I spent most of my effort. Air and water pollution, mostly air pollution. And the industry's early efforts to do what they could to minimize air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another subject we'll get to later.
I was just curious about putting the urgency of the war effort on top of that whole attitude about the environment and whether shortcuts were taken, even additional shortcuts might have been taken just to get the job done rather than worrying.
I think that's probably true, undoubtedly true, yes. I don't have anything specific in mind, but yes, I'm sure that getting the job done was number one.
And how big was this research group at Riverside?
At Riverside? I would guess, Jim, order of magnitude of 100 technical people with a couple of hundred support people.
It was a big operation.
Pretty big, of which maybe half the technical people were strictly lab chemists and physicists, and the others were chemical engineers working primarily on the pilot plants.
Okay. You had a number of patents and publications during that time. You had designed a flow meter, which I read somewhere else was called the McAfee gauge later on.
I think that baby was my one really original contribution to science and engineering, the McAfee gauge. It was really duck soup simple. It was kind of like the wheel or fire, but so simple that it was ridiculous in retrospect. At the time, we were working on propylene or propane dehydrogenation. We were trying to make propylene directly out of propane by a chromium catalyst, nickel chromium. And the charge was liquid propane, and we did not have a good way to measure it. And so the problem was, how do you measure the propane in pilot plant quantity? Of course, you can measure it regular meter, but we were talking about maybe a gallon an hour or something like that. So the essence of the McAfee gauge was to take a Jurgensen gauge glass, you know, a pressure gauge, and have a reservoir at the bottom alongside of it, and fill the reservoir with mercury. And then you attach it to the flow line up here, and in between where you attach the top of the Jurgensen gauge and the pipe that connected the top of the reservoir, you put a valve. And you'd have valves in the others, but they would be open. So, and normally the flow would be going through the open valve of the bypass. When you wanted to measure the rate of the propane, I pointed the wrong direction, it would go this way. You would close the bypass valve, which would force the propane down into the reservoir, which in turn would force the mercury up the Jurgensen gauge glass. And you would take a stopwatch, and you'd time how long it took to go from a mark on the bottom of the gauge glass to the top of the gauge glass. And because you had calibrated it, you would know how fast the stuff was going through. And if you were clever, you would open the valve in time to not have interrupted the flow and not carry mercury out into the system. That was the trick in the early embodiments of the invention. But it was so simple and so appropriate for the particular purpose at hand that it caught on like wildfire, and there were McAfee gauges all over the Riverside lab before I left. And as a matter of fact, when I came to work for Gulf, first time I visited the Gulf Research Lab, the very fancy lab at Harmerville, I was told, you're the McAfee of the McAfee gauge. So my name was made before I got there by that little contrivance. Later on, they got pretty fancy with it and built up an electronic system whereby you didn't have to remember to reopen the bypass valve in order to keep the mercury from going out and whatnot, and made it automatically, and they would count it and integrated it and digitized and whatnot, so it became quite a gadget, far beyond my poor power to have ever conceived it, but the basic idea was still the same. The other patents, just to touch on them for a moment,
okay,
were all improvement patents on various aspects of the processes we were working on. That was the nature of the beast. You had an idea of a little improvement here, a little improvement there. And UOP had a very aggressive patent department, which encouraged the prompt disclosure of ideas and then the pursuit of the ideas through the patent application and patenting phase. And a lot of things were patented that really had very limited significance on their own, although taken as a package, it made quite a package of patented information.
I know in certain areas there were government restrictions on releasing patents during the war for secrecy reasons. I know a lot of the fluorine compound patents from DuPont were held up until after the war because of the war effort. And I wondered whether there was anything in the oil industry that...
Not to my knowledge, Jim. There may well have been, but I wasn't that familiar with that end of the business, so I just don't know.
You and three others, Thomas, Anderson, and Becker, wrote an article in the Petroleum Refiner, Cracking with Catalyst. This is mid-war, in which you gave many details of the UOP process. But I was struck by one sentence in which it seems that it's certain that anhydrous aluminum chloride was the first catalyst used for cracking in this process. The process employing this catalyst was developed by A.M. McAfee in 1913 to 15. Must have given you great pleasure to be able to write that. And then here you are working in a similar area that your father had worked in.
It gave me great pleasure, but I didn't write it. Charlie Thomas wrote it.
Oh.
And he insisted we put that in there. I said, no, no, no. But he said, no, that's part of the background, and we ought to do it. So we did it. And, of course, I was pleased, yeah. And my dad was pleased.
Mm-hmm.
I'd forgotten that article. I'm interested that you dug it up.
I have a copy right here. Yes, in fact, your very first paper that I could find was published, you and Henry Hurst. What struck me there is it was published in the Proceedings of the Australasian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy, which I thought was a rather obscure... Unless there's another Jerry McAfee. It's atmospheric corrosion of extruded silver lead alloys.
No, that's
okay.
Not me.
Okay, then there's another Jerry McAfee.
Well, I'll be darned.
Out there.
There's also a Jerry McAfee who is a house painter in Houston.
Okay.
And there's one here in Pittsburgh who is a mechanic at the place where I bought my BMW.
Okay. Well, let's move on to golf then. How did your father feel about your coming back or coming to golf?
Oh, he was delighted. He was very pleased. He said, here comes my son and his family and grandchildren, and they made a great thing of it. And I had a pretty flexible job. It wasn't too well defined. And I was able to spend a good deal of time, particularly at lunch hour, with Dad. I would, after the hoi polloi, ate lunch before the big shots. My dad was at the big shot table. So we young engineers would go up and eat lunch and then had a half an hour or so afterwards. Most of the time of which I would go down and spend in my dad's office just chatting about things. And we spent a lot of good time together on that basis, learning about the company, talking about the company and whatnot. He never interfered. And I think we were pretty circumspect in what we talked about so that he didn't tell me his business and I didn't tell him mine. But I got a lot out of it by way of guidance and counsel and so forth. He was good enough, even before we got to Port Arthur, he he picked out a house for us and had it all ready to go, so it made the transition very easy. Shortly after we were there, we had a little girl to add to the two, and then and when we moved to Pittsburgh, we had our fourth child in Pittsburgh in 1950.
What were those 5 years like in Port Arthur before you came to Pennsylvania?
Well, my title was technical specialist, as I recall, which was a fairly broad title, and what they used me for, I was, I guess, the only doctoral level chemical engineer they had at the time, and there was a bullpen of young engineers that they put all of the young engineers into to start and gave them various technical assignments, and I was stuck in there. I had a desk over in one corner, and there were about 12 of us in that room, all working on more or less different assignments relating to the technical end of the operation of the refinery. It was a group that was fairly separate from, but which had to work cooperatively with the operating people. There was a certain amount of tension between the two, as you might well imagine, and one of the things that I had gotten out of my MIT practice school experience was the ability to get out in the plant and get my hands dirty and get a feel for the actual operation in a way that did not offend the operators, which is no small thing sometimes. And I was able to do that, and they assigned me to various troubleshooting jobs primarily at first. This still wasn't operating right, and what the heck's wrong, so I would make some analyses and make some recommendations, and sure enough, every now and then one of these things worked, and I got to be pretty well regarded as somebody that had some inkle of what was going on. At that time, while I was there, Gulf was enhancing its effort in research and development, particularly in catalytic research of various kinds, and in particular, they had under development a what we call hydrodesulfurization process, HDS, the idea of which was to make a relative low temperature and low pressure catalytically inspired hydrogenation for upgrading heavy oil. The basic concept, the basic objective, was based on the recognition that as you looked ahead in the crude oil supply situation, there were smaller and smaller available quantities of light, sweet crude, and more available, probably available quantities of heavy, sour crude. And the heavy sour crude needed to have asphalt removed and the sulfur removed in order to make it economically competitive with the light sweet crudes. And Gulf's reserves at the time and for a long time thereafter seemed to be concentrated in the heavy high sulfur end of the scale. So Gulf had a great interest in developing a process which would take this heavy gunk and make it into a better crude. So we had a major project in that area, and under the direction then of Dr. Paul Foote, who was head of the Gulf Research Lab at the time, there was also a concerted effort to try to bring about better cooperation between Gulf Research as an entity and the operating part of Gulf. And there again, you had the usual contention and tension between the technical end and the operating end. And the operating people regarded those boys at research as a bunch of kooks, and the kooks at research said those oafs in the refinery just don't know what it's all about. And therefore, there was a concerted effort to try to bring the two together. In order that this whole scheme involved setting up a series of committees in different areas, geophysics and geology and processing and products. And I was appointed to be the Gulf Refinery representative on one of the so-called research panels, which was primarily concerned with new processes. There was one on old processes in the sense of thermal cracking, and I was on the new process panel, of which hydrogen desulfurization was the principal flagship at the moment. And as a result of that activity, the HDS development was felt to be far enough along that it would justify a pilot plant of some significant size. So in the Port Arthur Refinery, under my direction largely, but with the cooperation of the Pittsburgh Engineering Department and the research people, we converted an old hydrogenation unit, which had been used for other purposes during some time period, not the war, but previously. It was old equipment, and we converted that into a pilot plant of some substance. It was 50 barrels a day or so, and it was a good-sized semi-commercial unit rather than a pilot plant, really, for the semi-commercial application of this HDS process, which by that time had gotten to be fairly well developed. It used a nickel-based, peculiarly, catalyst, but modified, and was effective, technically. And my principal assignment during most of that five-year period was to be responsible for the design and direction and operation of that pilot plant as a step in the development of the HDS process. We also had some other little pilot plant operations that came under my wing, but they were relatively unimportant. So that was my big assignment there, and it was all part of a very significant multi-million dollar research and development effort on Gulf's part. The outcome of all that was that the process was developed, and it was commercially used very successfully, but unfortunately not in any of Gulf's refineries. It was in other refineries which were, well, one in Okinawa, for example, was built jointly with Gulf was a part participant. And there were some others built from scratch. But it was the sort of thing that either had to be built into the plant originally or no go economically. It wasn't the sort of thing that you could very well integrate into an existing refinery, partly because it required hydrogen, obviously. And the competing economics of coking and thermal cracking and various and catalytic cracking, as catalytic cracking developed to accommodate heavier and heavier fractions, made its application in an existing refinery a very marginal thing, and it was a pretty highly capital intensive thing, so it wasn't something that was easy to sell upstairs. And I remember one of the questions that was put to me shortly after I became chairman. I came out to the research lab to make a presentation and say how the world looks from where I sit. One of the fellows that I've worked with over the years on this process said, "Jerry, now that you're the big shot and the CEO and all that, how come you haven't put in a HDS unit, Gulf Refiner?" Well, that's a good question. And I had to tell him that your perspective tends to change when you have to look at the overall economics and the bottom line, as well as the technical elegance of a project. And so it just didn't make economic sense.
I forgot I've got a...
We're about to use up your tapes. I'm going to have to hold myself in check.
No.